Welcome to Our Future Skies in partnership with AIG. I'm John Strickland. This is a podcast where we gaze into our crystal ball, we try to clear the fog and look at what the future may hold for the airline business. The industry has always been subject to shocks and upheaval, both natural and sadly, many man-made. And that's certainly the case now. It's not something I would expect to change in the coming years either. And the greatest of these challenges, which is absolutely staring the industry in the face, is that of sustainability. So understanding this, where could we imagine the industry might be in 10 to 20 years from now? What are going to be the key drivers and influences shaping its trajectory? To get some meaningful answers and informed perspectives on this, I'm talking across the series with industry leaders, drawing on their experience and knowledge and applying their thinking to our podcast. In this episode, we're going to hear from an industry leader with over 30 years' experience in the airline and travel sector, including time at American Airlines and as CEO of Vueling and chairman and CEO of British Airways. He's currently vice chairman of WestJet and advisor to a number of leading travel industry players. He describes himself as being focused on modernizing the airline industry, a theme which I'm sure we're going to come back to a number of times today. So with that short career resume, let's meet my guest today, Alex Cruz. Welcome to Our Future Skies, Alex.
Hi, John. Great to see you, as usual. Thank you very much for your invite.
Pleasure, Alex. Well, as I mentioned there, you've worked for a number of airlines across the US, Canada, and Europe, some with global networks like British Airways and American, and others such as low-cost carriers, Vueling in particular. Just give us a little flavor of what you see as the highlights of your career through those airlines and perhaps differences between those companies you've worked for, if you would.
I was incredibly lucky to join a small division of American Airlines in 1990 that was intent on, through statistical analysis and through software, significantly improve every aspect of the operations. And at that time, we did it particularly only for American Airlines. Every once in a while, we would get some airline visiting like KLM or VA or Cathay and say, hey, how do you do that? And we would actually just tell them, yeah, this is how we do it. And we would actually share algorithms and such. That was many, many, many years ago. And that group eventually grew in size. It grew in products and solutions and eventually rolled into a formal division of American Airlines, which at the time was well recognized as Sabre. So out of the 10 years that I was in that family, the very last year, I actually, or the last few months, I was no longer an American Airlines employee. I was a Sabre employee, and it was the end of a process. But it was an incredible learning. It was like an advanced MBA and doctorate at the same time, visiting airlines around the world. After that, I did about 5 years of consulting, where I started my own company. I ended up being a partner in Accenture, really providing more services and understanding how to help airlines around the world in a more formal setting, I would say. And it was at that time, 15 years into my professional career, that this project, ClickAir, started. That's a story of its own, pretty much. And in 2009, we merged with Vueling. And then 2013, we sold it to IAG. And then 2016, I joined BA. So 15 years of selling and 15 years of buying, if you were talking about a supplier. But obviously, the whole time learning nonstop about this incredible industry of ours.
An amazing career resume, Alex. And I touched on the fact you're still actively involved with airlines today as vice chairman of WestJet. Just a quick word on them as an airline for any listeners who may not be familiar with them.
So WestJet is one of two very large airlines in Canada, covering particularly the western side of Canada, with more than 150 aircraft, a few wide bodies flying into Europe, as well as Japan and Seoul, and providing a fantastic product both domestically and Caribbean, providing a vacations product for Canadians that go into mostly Caribbean, Mexico, etc. So really, really great airline under private ownership of Onex, primarily Onex, the private equity firm in Canada. And going through really a very diligent transformation, moving on to a higher margin company. So very excited to be part of that project, WestJet. Yeah.
Well, let's d dive in, Alex, now, based on all that experience, and look at the shape and structure of the industry and business models as we move into the future. As you've made clear there, you've worked not just for a number of airlines, but a range of business models. And just to add to what you said, Clicair, which was established by the Spanish national carrier Iberia as a low-cost airline at a time when I think it's fair to say low-cost airlines were far more embryonic. We had Ryanair around, but of course, today it's one of the leading, if not the leading business model. How do you see the landscape changing years ahead? Do you think low cost is still going to have a dominant strain? Is there still going to be a role for other types of airlines, such as hub and spoke network carriers like British Airways?
Yeah, before I answer the question, I make just expand a little bit on the description that you made of Clicair. Clicair was a complete success. It was executed perfectly. It generated an extremely dependable, high punctuality operation, and eventually ended up merging with Vueling, providing that underlying expertise on the operations side. Driven by a great guy, then ultimately went to turn around Iberia, Luis. But the reason why it was successful, it was because we fought and got the support to be independent from Iberia, which was one of the biggest problems that previous incarnations of airlines with airlines had not been able to do. So I just wanted to make that small change. There's been very, very few examples around the world of airline within an airline that have actually worked, and Clicair and obviously subsequently Vueling was one of those.
Now, I think it's an interesting point because, as you said, we have airlines today that are like daughter airlines, children airlines, you could say. In fact, they are treated like children by parental groups, and thus they never truly deliver what a low-cost airline should deliver in terms of profitability and innovation.
Exactly. And absolutely, Iberia was involved from the very beginning. You can't negate that. And they had an issue in the Barcelona hub and et cetera. But from a base that probably had 10, 12 aircraft, we turned it over the years to a base that had over 60 aircraft and 150 destinations. So it turned out to be a good story. Now, to your question, I think that we are going through a period of time where we are seeing multiple different effects to the different airline models around the world. But time goes by, and time going by means things happen. So let's talk about it. There appears to be, over the last few years, a slightly different story developing in the US versus Europe. We have seen the performance of true, really super ultra low cost carriers like Frontier and Spirit. Really taking a turn post-COVID and not really delivering the results that would be expected from them. And of course, there are reasons associated with their cost structure and, of course, from their competitive position vis-a-vis the traditional legacy large carriers, including my own alma mater, American Airlines, who not only benefited from, I would say, extremely beneficial, if not benign, conditions during COVID, but came up with products that were very, very competitive. The super basic fares of the larger carriers still are very flexible and allow you to stay within the ecosystem of those airlines and the frequent flyer programs, et cetera, et cetera. So that in the US has been quite interesting to develop. And moving forward, there are question marks about all the airlines that are within that segment, and fewer question marks about the longer term strategy of the big airlines. If we move on to Europe, we find a slightly different situation. I don't think it would be fair to link it strictly to the amount of state aid over COVID, but certainly that would have been one of the factors that would have influenced a slightly different situation where there was a imbalance in the amount of state aid. Some got none, some got a little bit, some got a lot throughout the European country and EU landscape. But what we find ourselves are the three main legacy airline groups who are performing from slightly below expectations to above expectations. That has been the tonic really leading up to COVID as well, but they keep going. They've got reasonable aircraft orders. We can talk about supply chain later, but they do have aircraft in their order books. They've got demand patterns that have been strong enough for them to deliver a good premium operation and benefit from premium, both premium emerging, re-emerging premium business, as well as a premium leisure, which has been the segment that BA had already begun to bet on big time before COVID, but certainly post-COVID appears to be resilient now, a few years after COVID. But low-cost carriers have also been doing okay, and we could comment on each one of them, but I don't think that there is, you couldn't possibly critique the performance of Ryanair or EasyJet with its EasyJet Holidays unit. And of course, Wizz Air's growth, which continues, and with huge plans. And yeah, you can look at the different differences in performance and network, etc. But they keep on trucking, and there is probably little doubt at this time that they're going to continue looking at ways to grow. Again, supplier problems aside and engine problems aside. So the landscape of Europe looks slightly more stable in that perspective, and it would be difficult to question the low-cost model, nor would you question the legacy model. In Asia, things are developing. We had a slower recovery post-COVID. It took longer, obviously driven by China International, which was the slowest to recover. We are now almost really fully recovered. Chinese carriers coming into Europe in force. We could also talk about what that means in terms of flying over Russia, the response by Europeans and Americans, etc. But the low-cost carriers, the fewer low-cost carriers that are there, they've been struggling in different kinds of ways. Still, some of them with engine problems, but they seem to have, like the Europeans, a pathway to continue growing and offering a product, particularly to price-sensitive travelers. We did see a resurgence of the national carriers post-COVID. Some of them had done their homework and they had cleaned their organizations significantly, and some others appear to still be lagging. So a mixed picture with some of the legacies for different reasons. Some from shareholding perspective, some from an operational perspective, some from supplier. So I think the picture in Asia yet to be developed. In Europe, I am confident that overall the supply of airline seats will continue. Yeah, lots of nuances and small things. And in the US, I think there is some question marks over the low-cost model and how that's going to develop.
Very interesting, Alex. And certainly it comes through in what you're saying there. There is still this significant influence. And personally, my belief that low-cost airlines or that model is the one which has most widely influenced change in the industry over the last 20 plus years, longer in the US. Now, your time at British Airways, and I stress we're not looking backwards now, we're looking forward. But your time at British Airways, I would say you took BA through an evolutionary change, really taking in some of those learnings of low cost. So some would say it was a revolutionary or too much change, but there was a different approach to where the airline flew. There was a different approach to how it flew out of Gatwick. There was the ability to buy on board, catering for economy customers. But do you think we're seeing enough change in that type of model broadly? You expressed your view that Europe is quite varied, but it does seem to me things that BA did a few years ago are now being emulated by other airlines, recognizing they have to.
Look, anytime you bring in the word change and the airline industry, we could talk for hours as well on that. We are generally a conservative, risk-averse industry, and rightly so in some aspects of the airline, of specific aspects of the airline. So I generally, when it comes to transformations of product, of network, etc., we tend to be slower in the way in which we implement these sort of changes. I think that we have been seeing certain products and service offerings developing over the years that have been undeniably better options for customers, better options for the airlines, and in many cases also better options for employees, because it allows better service to be provided, either more customized or less intensive in the way that is being delivered. So I think that we're still not truly settled. You know, if you look at some of the fundamental challenges that we have in the airline industry, like for example, boarding an airplane, we know that at any given time there are a few airlines that are trying another boarding procedure. And we know that there's some airlines that have tried hundreds. And I remember in Vueling that we tried a lot. I think that there is a continuous search to make sure that we become better, that we provide a better service to our customers, that we are more efficient. And I think it's a slightly generic answer to your question, but in reality, it reflects almost everything. Yes, I introduced Buy on Board in MBA, and yes, that was followed by other airlines in Europe. But at the same time, working together with the team, we realized that maybe 100% buy on board wasn't the right answer. And we began to design a different product, which is what BA currently has right now. And we're seeing other airlines doing exactly the same thing. Maybe 100% buy on board is not the right thing. Maybe we need to have a mixture of some free stuff and the choice to be able to offer. And I think that applies to everything. There is a continuous process of discovery. Understanding what is it that customers want, what is it that we can afford to deliver, and provide a reasonable return to those that give us the money to buy airplanes. And I think that will go on. We'll go on for, you know, you cannot really conceive a time in which someone says, okay, we're done. That's it. We don't have to change our procedures anymore. We've got the perfect setup. You know, even when you have a really, really top-notch, I don't know, let's choose business class catering, really fantastic. Well, the menus rotate. People's preference change. The percentage of people that want to have special meals change. So we are an industry that has to be designed, geared, organized, prepared, structured for continuous change to make sure that you can attend to the needs of all the different people, both employees, customers, shareholders, etc.
And you described there, Alex, about the industry being relatively conservative, but we still talk a lot, and there are conferences that thousands of people attend about product innovation and passenger experience and all these aspects of a business. And I wonder how much further we can go. I was talking to another guest on the series about some graphic I'd seen on social media. You may have seen it, which shows some couple in the glory days of aviation in the 1940s with groaning trays of sumptuous food by their side, and one saying to the other, "Imagine what it's going to be like in 50 years' time." And cut to the other picture of somebody with a little plastic cup of water and a packet of crisps, you know. And of course, it's a very much a schematic of those kind of changes, but that's not reality. There has been incredible product innovation in quality on board for the high end. Some elements of service withdrawal for economy, but not all. As you said, the menu of buyers you choose, and outside of the aircraft as well on the ground. Is that going to continue? I mean, what else can be done?
So a reflection on the past first. As an av geek, and I, there's a lot of aspects of historical aviation which are super interesting for me, and I've got books, and I am connected to the hip with the British Airways Heritage Museum because they've got such a vast source of pictures and data and accounts, and they're really an amazing group of people. When we see those pictures and those videos of 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, we only see those spreads of food, which, by the way, they're relatively easy to replicate in some respects. But what we don't see is the noise. We don't see what the experience on the ground was entirely. We don't see the fact that you had a completely different baggage arrangement. We don't see that longer haul flights had three, four, five, six stops. To be able to go there. And do I dare bring up the topic of safety? It was a completely different environment, right? So it is very difficult to judge the overall travel experience by what appear to be spreads of succulent food being presented. I think there's many, many, many other aspects. I think that we are at a point where you could probably argue that we are offering the largest amount of balanced luxury. We have the very best seats that have ever been available for customers flying on airplanes. They're available now within airlines that operate now. And I believe that there are a number of airlines around the world that are continuing to look for ways to innovate on that premium and super premium experience. I think we also have some unbelievable catering companies and airlines that are putting together incredible experiences on board. So from a luxurious perspective, yes, you have to pay for it, or you have to be ready to pay for it. But I'm not really sure that we are in a different stage. Of course, we have many more destinations. We have many more direct flights, and we have an incredible safety record overall. Moving forward, I suspect that we're going to continue evolving, and it will evolve on the side of technology. We didn't mention it, but I also sit on the board of Recaro, and the German manufacturing company that manufactures seats for aircraft. And we often are exposed to all types of technologies. I was at the AIX conference in Hamburg, and looking at multiple vendors. And really, it almost feels like the future of the in-cabin experience has, I'm not going to, I mean, you can say nearly infinite number of ways it's going to progress in order to make the experience more comfortable, more entertaining, and healthier. I think that there is going to be a huge push to help passengers to have a healthier experience, particularly on longer flights. Of course, you're familiar with the Sunrise Project and how Qantas, through the investigation process of how they would provide that really long flight experience, they looked a lot at the health aspects. And I think that's going to become a feature when we look at future seats that will be developed over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I think we should be assuming that there will be some health embedded related features within those seats, and certainly ability to track, the ability to know if you are laying down in the right position, if you're breathing well, if you're had too much noise or too little noise, or if you're eating properly. And of course, it will be linked to your own personal data in one way or the other. So health, entertainment, I think that the development of light and featureful hardware around your eyes, glasses, etc., it's really moving forward very fast. In another business I'm involved in, we have recently implemented mixed reality glasses as part of an entertainment environment, and it is really amazing what can be done in many respects. And I think that no, we're not ready for this. I remember many, many years ago, I don't know if you remember that Japan Airlines did a tryout of these headsets that would cover your eyes and such, but it didn't last very long. Fantastic to really try it. Something will come. We are going to see more and more passengers over time with things over their eyes that they will bring on their own. And at some point, I suspect airlines will provide some offering. I don't think it's in the near term, but I think it will happen over the next 5 to 10 years. So entertainment, health, and in the case of food, I think it will be about customization. I think that there is one unspoken, we don't talk about this very often, but I'm going to bring it up. There's one unspoken issue that we don't speak about a great deal, and that is the fact that we have a lot of room yet to optimize the supply of food into the airplanes. If you're a passenger, you may say, yes, because I never have the choice I want. Yes, that's correct. That's one angle. But the other angle is we probably throw away way too much food than we should. And at some point, that's going to become a real tangible pressure, where there will be a balance between those passengers that are willing to declare sometime in advance before their flight, you know, between an hour and a day or whatever, what is it that you want to eat, so that that provision of food can be very targeted and the amount of waste can be reduced. So I think customization of the food is probably the next frontier, and it will have huge benefits both for the customer, because the customer will have exactly what they want in the way they want it, and at the same time for the environment, and really frankly for society and for costs, by the way.
A very important point. And just coming back on the other point you made as well about health, we all know about the squashed in economy seats. And I know some airlines have tried to innovate already by offering fold down seats in economy. And I suppose we have that dynamic tension between trying to give that comfort and recognizing that 70, 80% plus of customers traveling, when surveyed, say that price comes before everything. We've recently, this is looking into the very immediate future, heard about a couple of airlines offering super long flights, 8 hours or so, on these narrow-bodied aircraft from the UK down to the Middle East with 240 seats. And I've been on these seats, as I'm sure you have. They're very thin and slim, efficient from the airline point of view, but I'm not convinced I'd want to sit there for 8 hours, least of all without a recline. So I think investment in that type of thing, as long as it doesn't knock out the economics, is something that's got to happen.
Well, I'm not sure if these operators of high-density 321s will have 234 seats on an XLR. I wonder. But at the same time, we must acknowledge that there are a number of well-known, very large, very prestigious airlines around the world that are flying 10 across on even 350s, certainly 777s. And for certain types of traffic, for certain types of network locations, it looks like the product works. And you may like it or you may not like it entirely, but it appears like it is a sufficiently adequate solution all across. So I think the jury is still out. Population keeps growing globally. And I suspect that we will get back to our usual 4% per year CAGR growth globally that IATA speaks about sometimes very, very soon. And we will need more seats. We seem to be at an impasse in terms of supply of airplanes and engines, etc. But we will catch up at some point. And I don't think that we should entirely rule out that that product that you talked about, John, will be present, will be part of the choice that we will have. It'll be a choice. It'll definitely be a choice. It will not be the only option, I suspect, to travel point A and point C.
And let's just look a little bit more abstractly. What about the geography of the airline industry's activity? Do you see that changing? Do you have a view about markets which will be on the rise or conversely even decline? And there I'm thinking, loaded question, even whether Europe could be left behind if we look at other markets around the world.
I'm probably not qualified to give you a strong enough answer. I think that there's a lot of issues associated with what you're saying, and of course, the time horizon makes a huge difference. If we're talking 10 years, 20 years, or 50 years, it looks like the European population, looking at the birth dates, is decreasing. Some countries more than others, some slightly better. The US population has other issues. The South American population continues to grow. China, of course, and India and Indonesia, with slightly different nuances to each one of them. That's why I made the comment earlier that globally, I suspect that we have a secured influx and demand in one way or the other. You sometimes wonder about aircraft orders. We've asked ourselves many times over our lives, isn't that too many aircraft? When we look at the Boeing and Airbus forecasts, which they release every year, and you go in the headlines normally is thousands of aircraft by 2050 and things like this, and you go, my God, that really is a lot of aircraft. Of course, some of those aircraft substitute existing aircraft because they become older, but you do wonder when you look at the existing orders of aircraft in Europe and you apply 50, 60%, make it a generous replacement percentage, and then you project it against potential demand cycles, you wonder a little bit. Now, I've been here before, so I wonder a little bit less than I used to wonder 10 years ago and 20 years ago, because ultimately, businesses, they want to be profitable, and people will adapt supply to capacity eventually. Sometimes people lose money for a period of time. So no matter what, I'm sure that supply will adapt. I wonder if the current supply planned in Europe will not result in a situation over capacity. There may be other natural reasons, well, I would say natural, human influenced reasons why that capacity cannot be fully rolled out, like, for example, air traffic control or infrastructure on the ground, etc. We'll see how it goes. When we look at the larger picture of aviation, the US continues to be an incredible market. If you follow new route announcements, if you follow the development of some of the carriers that have started around COVID over the last few years, you really are learning more geography in the US when you really thought that you had heard, 90% of the airports you would know. No, there are more and more cities that come up, possibly out of growth or business activity. So you get this feeling that the US has many, many, many airports that still could be developed more. On top of regional aviation and on top of private aviation, which, as you know, is the largest market altogether. So I would be careful at trying to put any limitations to the US market. Yes, they have a supply issue, and they have got an ATC, a growing ATC technology issue, as been discussed. But it looks like the opportunity is out there. And then we find ourselves with incredible India. Amazing Indonesia, China, which is absolutely fully intent on having its own hardware and its own airplanes, and which they're flying already. And I suspect that they will continue building them, and they will eventually build a wide-body aircraft, I'm sure. They're fully determined. The population of Indonesia developing significantly, and of course, India, where there is now. I don't know if it's thousands, but certainly is 1,500, 1,600 airplanes on order at the moment between IndiGo and India, etc. And that's a lot of capacity,
I
but
think a third of the new aircraft on order are for
are
India.
from India.
That's
So
right.
it's incredible. But it feels like that's a market where, so long as there is the right infrastructure, airport size terminals, runways, etc., that it will be able to fulfill it. We haven't spoken about the Middle East. The Middle East is, I think, the traffic. It's about a combination of making these Gulf cities a destination, and I think each one of the nations is spending a lot of time and money to really replicate the model of Dubai of many years ago, and in some of the other cities. But they still have a huge connecting role, without a doubt. And then the connecting number of passengers varies from airport to airport, but still very, very significant. I think that evolution sort of takes me to one of those thoughts of how is this going to work given the announcements of other airlines in the region.
Well, Saudi
And
Arabia, obviously, the elephant in the room with massive ambitions, of course.
absolutely. And they will. I was in Saudi Arabia for a week earlier this year, interacting directly with tourism and transport authorities, and they're absolutely determined. So I am sure that they're going to move forward and create a fantastic new airline with connectivity. Well, how is the picture going to come together with four or five connecting hubs in the area within an hour or two of flying of each other? We'll see. I think that there's some interesting questions to be made there. So globally, I would say US looks safe. South America and a number of places in Asia very much linked to their population growth. Europe, I think there's a few questions, but we will figure it out over time. And of course, we never speak enough about Africa.
Exactly.
And
I was going to say Africa is the one which should be the sleeping giant, but is always left behind and never quite seems to get adequately forward.
yeah, and I think we've been with from down south in South Africa to airlines like Fastjet to what Royal Air Maroc is doing and others, etc. And of course, Ethiopian as a powerhouse. I think we still have some barriers that need to be surpassed in order for traffic in Africa to pick up, particularly intra-Africa. I think the connectivity of Africa outbound to either Gulf hubs or places in Europe or even in the US or Asia will continue to grow out of just pure trading between the individual countries and those regions. But where there appears to be a significant deficiency is in intra-Africa routes. And I think that There is work that is being done in a number of countries, mostly bilaterally, to get over those barriers. But I think there's some work to be done yet. And of course, the African market will continue through investment to grow. But that's emerging, and I think it will go slow. It will take a little bit of time.
And in terms of that geographic mix, you've touched on aircraft types, and we've mentioned about the rise of long haul narrow body aircraft, for example. But we're going to be out of super large aircraft in the 2030s at some point, when the last A380 double deckers come out of service. And there's mixed views here. Some say, including Tim Clark from Emirates, who we've also had on the series, that we are really going to be hamstrung if we don't have more airport capacity coming on stream in many parts of the world. Without these large aircraft, capacity is going to be coming down, prices are going to be coming up. What are your thoughts about the mix of planes, or the lack of new aircraft on the books now of the major manufacturers?
For Tim, of course, it's a huge deal because he is the largest operator of 380s. So that his comments make a great deal of sense. At the same time, I think there are further unlocking mechanisms that are being developed and that are slowly resurging. First of all, we need to, whatever possible, in whichever way, continue to help Boeing. And we all hope that Boeing will continue to develop properly, because that 777-9, as defined, as currently conceived and being tested, it's an aircraft that will be able to carry as many passengers as a 380, as most people's configurations on a 380. Yes, you have the 615-seater of Emirates on that two-class configuration, but I would call that an unusual configuration in some respect. No, I don't, I'm not entirely sure you could get 600 seats, possibly in an all economy configuration. I don't know. I shouldn't speak about it on the 777-9, but I think we're going to have that 777-9 option at some point. I think that the evolution of the 350-1000 also offers some interesting perspectives. I think that some of the airlines have been playing around with different and cabin configurations, which do provide a much larger capacity. So overall, in terms of total number of seats, I am a little bit less worried. I think that the mix of premium and non-premium seats is probably the larger and more difficult topic. We are living a time post-COVID where premium is working, seems to be working. Premium seats, particularly in long haul, appear to be in high demand. There is a reasonable question mark, now that we've made the investment on those premium seats, if that's a trend that is going to exist forever, if that demand for premium seats is going to be there, if at some point the premium leisure customers are going to say, yeah, I cannot afford $10,000 next year on my holiday. I'm going to do 4,000. Or whatever the equivalent is, and downgrade from business class or first class. So for me, the issue, it's a little bit less the availability of capable, longer haul, high capacity airplanes. It's more about being able to have the right mix of seats within some of those airplanes. And yes, we will miss eventually the exit of the 380, as much as many of us are still not completely over the
The
exiting
747.
of the 747, was as you know, I was involved in that process. But I think we have to put romanticism to the side. At least I have to, in some respects, and focus on what are the right tools to continue developing our industry. And we might be a little bit behind at some point, but we will recover, and we will have enough options. For me, it's mostly about cabin configuration.
And just very briefly before we move on from aircraft types, Alex, I mean, where do you see innovation coming from beyond what you described as the yet to be in service Boeing 777-9 in the next 2 or 3 decades? I mean, do you hold out any hope supersonic can come back? And although a little off-piste for this particular podcast, much talked about now, urban mobility, VTOLs, air taxis, and so on, which I
Absolutely.
must admit, I've got a high degree of skepticism about. Perhaps I'm too much of an old timer.
I have a great level of excitement. Look, For anybody that likes aviation, and one of the things that I do in my life is preach and recruit younger people into our industry, because I often tell the story that my dad's dad, my grandfather was a postman. He was in charge of sending telegrams with Morse code, and then my dad became a merchant marine captain. And before my grandpa died, he said, "You're gonna stick with this airplanes thing, because this airplanes thing, it looks like it's like it's gonna work." And we find ourselves in this time with the most exciting and biggest list of aviation projects that we've ever had before. And I'm working with somebody to figure out, I think it possibly may be the time in history when the largest amount of money is being invested in aviation related projects. And this is super exciting. And you mentioned some of the things, and each one is slightly different in terms of what it has to offer. eVTOLs is about vertical takeoff, going somewhere, and vertical coming down. There's so much money pumped in, and there are so many people trying to pursue it, that I think it's reasonable to think that at least eVTOLs at some point will substitute a pretty good percentage of helicopters. I think that's a reasonable assumption. It's exciting when you talk to I've spoken with three of the main players, and they are absolutely convinced. Of course, money and raising money, because this is a complex certification and development process. But we often get too distracted by this. The fact is that we have many projects about hybrid airplanes, hybrid engines, electric engines, initially of low capacity and low range, which are really, really, really exciting. We are now obviously being exposed to new types of airplanes, delta wing sort of design airplanes. Honestly, I was speaking with a company last week that are heavy, long distance cargo drone providers. So you can take something 200, 300, 400 miles on an automated drone from point A to point B, strictly cargo. I mean, it really is amazing, the amount of projects. So I suspect that many of these will end up on actual feasible, potentially initially niche products. I mean, there's nothing that is going to substitute an airplane that flies between London and New York with 300 people inside for a really long time. But yes, I think that so long as we continue raising the enthusiasm about aviation and how unbelievable, what an unbelievable industry it is, I think we will get funding to be able to see through many of these projects. And particularly, I find it fascinating. I'm depressed that almost every week I hear about a company that I should have known about that is already trialing out a new device, a new plane, and it's how come I didn't know about this? And it's really exciting. I'm mentoring one young CEO of an emerging company that is looking to substitute entirely private jets with a significantly much more ecological solution. And if anything, you see very, very smart people, but with a high degree of dedication, conviction, and extremely good selling skills when they raise money. So I think we're going to see some amazing things coming up in our industry.
Very interesting. And that dovetails nicely, Alex, into the broader topic of technology, which is what I'm waiting for. So don't disappoint me, Alex. I see this as much the key area for you. I've always seen you as interested in all aspects of technology and leading edge. So how do you see the growing role of technology and digital in the industry? We know, and you've been there, you've overseen an airline that had, in some ways, sticking plaster solutions, decades of putting new adjuncts onto old systems, and then they all fall over spectacularly and end up causing mayhem with headlines. It happens again and again. It's still happening now. How is technology going to play out for the airline industry? Is the industry going to succeed to get a grip, to make progress so that it can deliver both a robust operation and an efficient one using all the advantages that technology can bring?
We don't have an alternative, John. We have to do it. So far, the discussion of the last few minutes, was about hardware and flying related. Your question is more about software and what actually powers and enables the operations and
The business in every
the
respective
business, that's
customer
right,
relationships.
of airlines. The facts we all know, the industry at large, particularly commercially and mostly operationally, operates over a set of principles and premises that were defined 60 or 70 years ago. And there are still a number of IT systems which come from those times, which are still supporting the operations of many airlines around the world. But it's important that we understand. I often speak with suppliers that are baffled at how we ended up being ourselves in this situation. But you have to understand how difficult of a decision is as a CEO or as a CIO or CTO in a large airline when you're presented with two choices. Choice number one is you continue paying 100, 200, 300, 400, half a billion a year to maintain this system, which, yes, it breaks sometimes, but most of the times we manage it and nobody really finds out. And every once in a while, it's a major stuff, but we're going to try to avoid it and we're going to do some things to try to avoid operational disruption. That's door number one. Or door number two, I am going to start a very long project that is going to cost many billions over a long period of time to try to turn this whole thing around. And I think it would be fair to say that over the last 20, 25 years, the majority, I wouldn't say all, but the majority of CEOs, when confronted with that choice, they've chosen door number one. And they say, well, let's go over what we know, the evil we know, and let's try to maintain those systems, try to progressively upgrade small bits of those systems that I have. I think that as we move forward, we not only have the technical debt challenge, which is the systems getting older, more difficult to have access to skills of people to maintain those systems, but we are having competitive pressure. We no longer compete amongst ourselves within the airline industry. Yes, some people have newer systems and they can have fantastic apps or fantastic online experiences, and everything is very, very good. Not very good, but better. And others are stuck in terrible user interfaces. But we're no longer competing with each other alone. We are competing against online retailers that have nothing to do with transport, that are pumping in billions into making their digital native platforms even better. And you know, one of the fears that I've always had over the last 3 or 4 or 5 years is if Amazon knows so much about me and sends me the perfect message at the perfect time about the perfect product, I might just spend enough money so that I don't go to Paris for the weekend that I was going to go. And all of a sudden, I just took off four leg segments out of demand. But it's not just Amazon. It's all kinds of retailers that are becoming really, really, really smart, and they're getting a larger percentage of share of wallet. Whilst we in the airline industry are trying to serve better food and are trying to be on time. Absolutely. We have to do that. So the way forward, it feels like, and I was 2 weeks ago with a collection of 15 CTOs from airlines and aerospace companies, and there's a general consensus that this is the situation. But the way out appears like it has to be incrementally, but slightly more aggressively. And this means mapping out what that substitution of my current landscape of all systems is going to be, and be prepared to take a small set of business changes, because often technology does not adapt 100% to the way that you operate. So you may have to have some procedures that are slightly different, with the aim to do it a little bit faster. What we can say is that the systems that are 50 or 60 years old, in 20 years, they'll be nearly 100 years old. And that's, you cannot conceive that you're going to have hardware. I was told
That's
some.
incredible when you think about it that way. It's
No,
absolutely
no, it's
incredible.
it's crazy. But it was very humbling to hear from some of these CTOs from very relevant companies that they were having to go to eBay to find some used parts that fitted in some specific hardware that had been stopped in production a really long time ago. And they talked about the skills that they need to train new graduates on programming languages that you and I barely recognized from when we were younger. So this is crazy. So I believe the commercial pressure, together with the pressure to upgrade or die from a technical perspective, is going to take us to a better place. The last comment I would make is, as a CEO, this is not straightforward. So the question is, where am I going to be getting? Do I have the right team to do it? Do I really believe it? And do I have the money to do this? Because this is going to cost a lot of money. And I think that's going to be putting pressure on prioritizing the introduction of new technology that actually delivers more value already. So at the moment, we're seeing airlines around the world. I think the US market is slightly more mature, introducing very sophisticated disruption management software. And that has immediately a value. The moment that there is a disruption, things are done automatically with passengers and with crews in a significantly much better way. And you will have seen that we had the CrowdStrike event some months ago, and some airlines did really well, and some others didn't do as well. So I think, for example, prioritizing that, prioritizing solutions in pricing and revenue management, which typically do not involve a lot other than a commercial department and a revenue management department, will release extra money, will generate benefit and value that will be able to be reinvested to work on the more boring but extremely necessary infrastructure and middleware that we urgently need in our industry. So long answer, but that's where I think we are.
But a big subject, undoubtedly, for the future. I mean, just also briefly, do you think there is a way to share this work right across the, you know, the value chain? Because we can be quite siloed. You know, airlines do one thing, airports do another thing, suppliers, travel agents, whatever, but they all do other things. But we share the same customer through that process. Is there something to do which would not only make the result better for customers, but it ought to be more efficient financially if everybody shares the pain or shares the investment? As far as possible.
Yeah, as you speak, the first thought is not a chance, but I would caveat that a little bit. I think that there are individual bilateral relationships which are becoming better with time, but at a very slow pace. So the relationship between airlines and airports, it really depends of which airports and which airlines, but you are seeing more cooperation in a number of areas because otherwise, by having that cooperation, it lowers costs and it manages disruptions better. So I see a general, very slow trend between airlines and airports. I think when you look at airlines and travel agencies, there's a number of dynamics, which commercial dynamics and profitability dynamics, which probably force that relationship to evolve over time in a way that may be even more unbalanced, or balanced in a different way that it was traditionally balanced. So ultimately, the CEO of an airline has a responsibility to his or her shareholders, employees, and customers. And I think that when it comes to prioritize how much of the investment goes into improving the experience in someone else's turf, sometimes that gets relegated because you want to make sure that that experience is the best when the customer is within your own real estate. So it would be unfair to say not a chance. I think that there are a number of initiatives and across a number of industry bodies to make it better. I think that the rate of improvement will be similar to the rate of improvement over the last 50 years, which is tends to be slow, but every once in a while we have some real great results. So I'm encouraged.
Alex, we're moving on rapidly through our available time today. So I want to fire a few quick fire questions at you now before we wrap up. So some snappy answers, please, on some pretty weighty topics, but we'll give them a quick 2 minutes of your thoughts. What do you think of the biggest challenges for airline leaders going forward, particularly with regard to, you know, the state of the world geopolitics? Is that going to become something more difficult to navigate? or is it going to be as is?
Short term tricky. We are ready to manage as an industry different geopolitical issues. We've done it in the past, and in the long term, business as usual.
Sustainability, we mentioned it at the beginning. It is the elephant in the room. We've discussed it quite widely on this series, and we can't do justice in one podcast. But we're moving slowly, far more slowly than we need to. Your views, Alex, on whether we're going to get there, and if so, how?
It's here to stay. The fourth stakeholder, not necessarily the fourth in order, but certainly a new stakeholder. The commitment by the majority of the airlines is absolutely there. And I think now it's about authorities and airlines, and in many cases, airports and other parties working together. There's not enough SAF production. Yes, we know it. Yes, there is a lot of technology which is going to be developed. We've got 10, 15 years ahead of us in which we have to increase the amount of work that we do together, because there's not going to be step change solution available, which has to be a new airplane, new engine, or something like this. So we know more or less what the different avenues of work are. We just need to work together at it. But sustainability is here, absolutely, to stay, without a doubt.
And you talked about the cost in technology. I mean, this is again enormous cost, another essential investment.
Look for ways to generate value so that you can reinvest in technology. And yes, there are solutions now and areas in which you can increase value generation within airlines and create a buffer to continue investing in technology. Yes.
Consumers, our travelers, consumer rights protection has been getting heavier and heavier, particularly in the US and Europe. It's a heavy load for airlines. They're spending millions each year on compensation for an increasing variety of reasons. Is that going to become more so? Is a breaking point going to be reached?
I think that most airlines will agree that when it's my fault, I cannot complain and I have to pay out and do whatever I have to do to restore the confidence of the traveler. We do find ourselves operationally today in many situations when it is not our fault. It is clearly, understandably, someone else's fault. Well, let's not go into it. Just sometimes it's weather events, etc. In those cases, it's very unfair for the airline to actually have to pay for the mistakes of others. So I think that you will see airlines continue to put a lot of emphasis on operational reliability, but we are probably at a stage where this emphasis now it's also being dedicated, it's being allocated to manage the problems of other people in order to minimize the number of compensation events. So if I know that I'm going to be having a problem in southern France because there's going to be some strikes by ATC, what is it that I can do to prepare in terms of backup aircraft and my schedule, managing the situation, anticipating moving passengers around, etc. And airlines are becoming more diligent at doing that, but it's not their problem. It's someone else's problem and how that gets managed. So I think we have to find a happy medium. So there are a number of situations, and IATA is extremely diligent at denouncing those really unreasonable situations, and we'll continue to work with them to make sure that we help governments make the right decisions in this respect, and absolutely be as diligent as possible in compensating passengers when it's entirely our fault, and then prepare to minimize disruption when it's not our fault.
And people, Alex, you and I both do a certain amount of mentoring. We talk to a lot of young people, which you already described as having a lot of energy and entrepreneurial flair. What opportunities and motivations are there for young people to continue to join this industry?
Look, in a way, the fact that we only talk about this at the end of the conversation is really not representative of how you and I feel about this, and certainly
Absolutely not.
how I feel about this. We've talked about hardware, software. We've talked about airplanes. We've talked about network and geopolitics. But at the end, what makes an enterprise, a business, an industry successful is the people that are inside, and that are working and that are committed to it. I think that we have an incredible industry overall. The majority of the people that work in this industry and have been in this industry for a while are committed for life almost. We can't exit it. This is it. We've always been it, and we'll never leave. And we love it, and we breathe it every day. Transmitting that degree of enthusiasm to a profile of youngsters, which is different from what we were, for sure. many years ago, still possible. And it's possible because we've got sexy tools to attract them into. And sexiness comes in different ways, and I shouldn't use that word per se, but the attractiveness of aviation can come through many angles. I've spoken with some passionate young people who can care less about commercial aviation, but they care about the sustainability aspect in aviation, and they really want to work to improve every aspect of sustainability in aviation. Fantastic. Then we've got people that really like the different types of transport mechanisms. Fantastic. I think we've got enough hooks to be extremely competitive and relevant and to really recruit a lot of people. And then, yes, absolutely, please come to one big, large, boring airline. We're doing a lot of really interesting stuff. And any airline around the world, there are some really amazing things happening at the moment. And I think overall, I talked to high schools, students, A-level, sixth formers, and university students all the time. And it's not difficult to create a certain buzz about how exciting it is without rubbishing too much the other industries. But we are an exciting industry. It's getting more exciting, and there are a limited number of problems, and I am convinced that we will be able to continue attracting youngsters into it.
Well, I was going to ask you some final reflections on the state of industry going forward, but in many ways you've answered that. Anything else you'd like to add to that, Alex?
No, just continue relaying this sense of excitement. Hard work ahead of us. We cannot negate the fact that we are not just any industry. We're very, very, very complex. And we need to be ready, everyone in this industry, to work probably harder than others, but the rewards are high. And to see the world evolving, improving communications, improving the sustainability of the world, making it a better world is something our industry is a very, very huge part of that.
Well, Alex, I've enjoyed chatting with you about your vision of the future, and I'm confident we'll see you making more contributions to the industry in the years ahead. So, Alex Cruz, many thanks for your time.
Thank you, John. Great pleasure.
Thanks to you for listening, and I'll be back soon with our next Our Future Skies episode in partnership with AIG. But for now, from me, John Strickland, goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views, policy, or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by the speakers in this podcast series is their opinion and is not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or group of individuals, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no warranty or representations as to the accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series, and AIG will not be liable for any errors, inaccuracies, or omissions in the information provided during this podcast series, or any damages, losses, liabilities, injuries resulting from or arising from the podcast, including your use of the podcast.